and welcome to COVID Cast, a weekly Lowy Institute podcast for anyone interested in understanding the effect of coronavirus on the world and international life. My name is Roland Raja, and I'm the lead economist and director for international economics at the Lowy Institute in Sydney, Australia. As this crisis unfolds, we are sitting down every week with experts from a range of fields to discuss the implications of coronavirus for the world. You'll find all the previous episodes on the homepage of our website. In this episode, I'll be speaking with Pascal Lamy on the future of globalization. Pascal has served at the peak of global trade and economic governance. He was the Director General of the World Trade Organization for 8 years, from 2005 to 2013. And before that, he was the Trade Commissioner for the European Union from 1999 to 2004. Currently, he is President Emeritus of the Jacques Delors Institute, a policy think tank in Paris. Pascal, thanks for joining me today.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
So let's start with the big picture. I mean, COVID-19 is obviously a huge shock to globalization. Borders have literally been shut. International supply chains have been severely disrupted. Governments around the world have stepped in really big ways that could be trade distorting. Protectionist measures and sentiment seems to be rising very rapidly. All political leaders basically seem to be talking about reshoring manufacturing, and certainly very few want to talk about how keeping their own markets open is critical to their own economic recoveries. And of course, there were a whole host of problems that were there before COVID came along, not least the trade war between the US and China, the broader protectionism of the Trump administration, Western concerns about China's party state economic model, problems at the WTO, so on and so on. So just to sort of kick things off, I thought I'd just ask, you know, taking all of this in and given your experience at the apex of not just globalization, but arguably the politics of globalization, I mean, how do you see the overall picture? I mean, what concerns you?
Well, I think you've already mentioned quite a number of factors at play, some from before the COVID crisis, others which the COVID crisis will have triggered. Overall, we are in for a few years where there will be more obstacle to trade and investment, which means that the speed of globalization and its shape will both change. Not, in my view, towards a de-globalization. Often said, globalization is efficient and painful. Deglobalization is inefficient and painful. So I don't think we will have a deglobalization, but we will have a slowing down of globalization stemming from factors you mentioned. Number one, a huge amount of helicopter money in a number of very large big players, China, US, EU. And there's no way such an amount of trillions and trillions and trillions will not distort trade. So the playing field will have been unleveled by this huge state intervention. There is all this conversation, which you rightly mentioned, about reshoring, because some of the supply chains have shown to be a bit fragile. Although on this, there will be more bark than bite. There will be a bit of reshoring, specifically in sectors like the pharma industry. Although when you look at, for instance, the way the food chain works in the case of China, US, EU, which are the most obvious ones, it worked reasonably well. So it is not a big problem. It is probably a problem which is limited to some sectors. And I think I will add one factor, which I see as very important for the future, which is what I call precautionism, as opposed to protectionism. Protectionism is about protecting your producers from foreign competition, and we've known that for 20 centuries, basically. Precautionism is protecting your people from risks. COVID will increase the overall level of precaution which populations will request from their governments. And this repricing of risk will increase areas like safety, standard, security. The problem being that precaution is a very culturally, philosophically, politically connected issue. What is a good level of precaution for you may not be a good level of precaution for me and the other around. So the problem is that as opposed to tariffs or quantitative restrictions, I mean, the usual tools of protectionism, which in a way you can level by getting rid of them. Addressing precautionism is complex because it scatters the playing field with very different ways of establishing the proper level of precaution and then administering it. So there is a big problem in a further fragmentation. Leveling the playing field in precaution is much more difficult than leveling the playing field in protection. So we're in for quite a bumpy road in this international economic trade investment relationship.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point, Pascal. And as you know very well, I mean, one of the biggest problems in all of these negotiations and globalization, the World Trade Organization, is these different preferences about how things should function, how non-tariff barriers should function, and what you just described in precautionism. Sounds like it's just going to open up a whole new can of worms on that front. So, I mean, the premier venue where one would theoretically hope for there to be a solution is the World Trade Organization. But obviously, the WTO is basically in some sort of institutional crisis at this point. The current DG has resigned early, leaving in August. They're on the lookout for a new one. The dispute settlement body is basically paralyzed and has that parallel arrangement set up by the Europeans. And negotiations have also been basically stuck for a very long time. So, I mean, these are all old issues, but you were obviously at the WTO for 8 years. I mean, what's the actual prospect for the WTO actually being able to come together, basically the members of the WTO to come together to actually move things forward? I mean, there's a basic question of saving what's there, and then there's also a question of moving forward. From your own experience, how do you see those things, the prospects?
Well, I think you're right. The WTO is weaker than it was, let's say, 10 years ago. And that stems mainly from a increasing divergence in what you call the collective preferences between US and China. Not that they are the only elephants in world trade. EU is also an elephant. But this tension has, in a way, prevented what previously were convergences. And updating the WTO rulebook, which is what reforming the WTO is about, it's a simpler, reforming WTO is a simple way of saying updating the WTO rulebook for people who do not understand that the WTO is basically a rulebook. It needs to be adjusted, it needs to be modernized, not least because the last time the building was set up was roughly 30 years ago. The world has changed. At the time, for instance, when China entered the WTO 20 years ago, China was a mid-sized developing country. Now it's become a huge elephant. The problem, for instance, we have with China, that the state-owned part of the economy is roughly 30%, is a big problem, because if your state-owned sector is 30%, the suspicion among trade partners, right or wrong, is that this is because it needs support from the state. And inevitably, this leads to competition distortions, either on the Chinese market, which now is a vast and enormous market, or internationally, when firms have to compete with Chinese exporters. So this is one area where there is an obvious discrepancy between the size of the WTO disciplines and the size of the problem. WTO disciplines in what we would call state aids are shallow, weak, and they need to be strengthened. This will not happen without EU, US, China, Japan, to take this for converging to some sort of understanding of what, and I'm using the Chinese expression intentionally, what is competitive neutrality. So these things are ahead of us. They couldn't be solved in recent times. Of course, we know and we hope that the Trump trade policy would have been a parenthesis in the history of U.S. Trade economics. We're not sure about that, as we all know. So let's leave aside this factor, and we will probably have a clearer view of that after the presidential elections. For the rest, the geopolitical rivalry between U.S. and China is here to stay, and you're well-placed in Australia to know that and to understand that, and maybe even more than us Europeans who are a bit further from the scene. This will necessitate a stronger willingness to converge in the WTO. This will not happen in 1 or 2 years. In my view, the WTO agenda is short-term. As you said, first, they have to recruit a good director general, and there's an open competition that should unfold after the summer break. Short-term, during 1 or 2 years, I think the WTO needs a sort of cooling down period, given the big trade distorting impact of COVID and the way COVID was dealt with. There is a need for easing this out, for containing further trade distortions. And I think we need a sort of, you know, coalition of the willing that say, look, guys, now is the time to stop these very exceptional behaviors and policies. 1 or 2 years of cooling down, and then go back to the main issue, which is where WTO needs to be reformed. And the ones that need that most may not be China or US or EU or Australia. The one that definitely need a solid and properly moving WTO are developing countries, the sort of other half of the world economy, which still needs to develop, which still needs to get less poor. And we all know that international trade and investment is a big lever for them. And if the WTO keeps weakening, this is bad news for them. So the ones that should coalesce and say, we need a solid overall obstacle reducing machinery are developing countries, and especially given that they will have been hit disproportionately by the COVID crisis, whether sanitary-wise, but socially and economy-wise. So I think this is the big challenge, and I think this will appear quite soon. For the moment, we're all focused on the social unemployment consequences of that in big markets, rich countries. I think this train, which is a big train, is hiding another train, which is coming full speed, and which is the immense damage this crisis will have made on emerging and developing countries, Latin America, Africa, of course, and some parts of Asia.
I very much agree with that point, but I guess the question is, and I do want to get your views on a few other issues, but just sticking to this quickly, the question is it realistic that the WTO is going to be able to do both? There's a big structural issue between China and the US, and Europe's a part of that. But then, as you say, there's what the developing countries want, which is slightly different. Can it do both? Can they move in parallel, or is one going to block the other?
I'm not sure they are different. I think the notion that the playing field still needs to be leveled and needs to be re-leveled after the COVID crisis is a major issue for developing countries. After all, the big shots with strong currencies can pour trillions of monies into their economies. The poor ones cannot. And this is creating a further obstacle to their development because they have to compete with coffers that are absolutely enormous and which they don't have. So I think when this appears very clearly, the notion that it needs to be rebalanced, something needs to be done, will, I think, be pervasive. Of course, up to developing and emerging countries to organize themselves. And of course, then you have this problem, you know, whether China is on their camp or whether China is more now on the camp of European countries. And this makes things complex as we see it in the UN, for instance. I think this is the big issue that will appear very clearly 1 or 2 years from now.
Before we move from the WTO, I just want to ask you one question about China in the WTO. Many of the accusations or complaints, rather, that the Trump administration has had about the WTO and China's role in it, I guess many people might say there's some legitimacy to that, but no one, people don't agree with the tactics, so to speak. But two things are sort of implicit, which I think might be interesting to get your view on. One is that the Trump administration has said that there was always an expectation at the beginning that China in joining the WTO was supposed to converge on market-based approaches and that it didn't. And the second one related to that is that although it plays by the rules on paper, it doesn't play by the rules in principle. And other countries are left playing a game of whack-a-mole and dealing with a lack of transparency and these sorts of things in trying to get China to adhere to the rules. I mean, how do you react to that, given you've been involved with the WTO for so long and even before you were the DG as European Trade Commissioner? Do you think that those views have currency?
I've always said that there was one point on which I agreed with Trump on trade, which is that the existing set of disciplines does not constrain enough a number of Chinese trade distorting practices. I think this is a fact. Now, whether China should have converged, has converged, will converge, I think your starting point is absolutely right. When China joined the World Trade Organization at the time, that's 20 years ago, and I was European Trade Commissioner at the time, I negotiated the China-WTO deal for the European Union. The view prevailing was that one day, maybe that day was very far away, China would converge with global market capitalism. And by the way, this is what happened until the 08 crisis. The turning point when China started deviating, i.e. started not only increasing its state-owned enterprise, but using it more, is the 08 crisis, plus the political change that came a few years later with Xi Jinping, who's much more of a, let's say, true believer in the virtues of communism for China. So we are now in a situation where, you're absolutely right, China and the rest of the world have stopped converging. And what we have is to organize coexistence. And we have to convince the Chinese that if they do not accept more disciplines on, for instance, state aid, then others will stop opening trade to China the way we've been doing it. And that's what they have to understand. They still need a lot of exports in order to grow their economy. And this realization will have to happen someday. And I agree with the notion that the way Trump did it is not the right way. We have to be more cooperative, but also be able to exert the pressure in a way that percolates within the Chinese system, and not in a way that unites the whole Chinese system against a foreign power which is trying to arm twist my country. That's, I think, if you know a bit of China, and it's a quite diverse country, including in political economic conception, there is a way probably to lead them to understanding where their own interest is. On your second point, I've always said China does not cheat in WTO. China applies the rules it has subscribed to. And by the way, when it doesn't do it, it's taken to disputes and loses the dispute. And they've lost quite a number of disputes in WTO. They won some, but they've also lost quite a number of them. The problem is that the rule book is not adapted to the existing situation. So whereas China can be criticized for not respecting the spirit of blah, 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 a treaty is not a spirit. A treaty is a written commitment, and you have to put the spirit into the letters, and then you check whether people or not abide to it. And that takes us back to the notion that the WTO rulebook needs to be adjusted in a number of areas in order to constrain better China, probably not only China. As we all know, the US, for instance, do not have a clean nose on farm support. This is also an area which for many countries on this planet matters a lot.
Excellent points, Pascal. I think very powerful points as well. Very short on time, but I'm going to ask anyway. Australia and the European Union are negotiating a free trade agreement right now. Key part of that for the EU is adherence to the Paris Agreement and decarbonisation policies. Australia is not exactly a front runner in this space. So how hard do you think Europe is going to push Australia here, and what's at stake? Could this scupper the whole thing?
Yes, it could. And if I compare the situation to what it was 10 years ago and look at years ahead for the EU trade policy, there has been, will be a shift to a new trade policy, which is A, greener, and B, more defensive. Doesn't change the fact that it will remain pro-open trade. And the fundamental reason for that is that the medium-long-term forecast for the growth of the EU economy is low as compared to the rest of the world. And these growth differentials, this growth differential creates an inbuilt bias in favor of more market and investment opening. Yet, following recent European elections last year, following movements within the political exchequer on the continent, the Green constituency is politically growing, becoming very strong, and the Paris Agreement, biodiversity considerations, climate change, energy transition will be a big part of EU conditionality in trade agreements. And I recognize that given where Australia is for the moment, and we know that if we look at the 20 last years, Australia has been a bit of up and down on climate change and environment and this arbitration, which you have to do between saving the planet and putting more costs on part of your exporters. I think at some stage, the negotiation will be very tough on that. The notion by the EU will probably be, I'm sorry, I'm a bit cynical, we are a very big market. Australia needs more opening on this market. There is a price to pay for that, which is that Australia goes greener. It probably will be done in more diplomatic terms, but brace for a situation like this. This is not just Australia. For instance, the deal which EU clinched last year with the Mercosur, which is a done deal, will not be ratified by the European Parliament as long as forests are destroyed in the Amazon. So this has become a major issue. And I think EU trade policy going green, including, for instance, with the border carbon adjustment system, and the Institut Jacques Delors in Brussels has just published a full-fledged template of how it would like. So if Australian negotiators want to know where the EU is going, look at this piece. It is a model of what the next step, which is this border carbon adjustment, in order, if you increase the price of carbon within the European Union, which they want to do to avoid carbon leakages, this is where we have to go now.
Okay, we might have to leave it there, but an important point to end on, Pascal. So let me thank you again for joining me for today's discussion on the COVID-19 and the future of globalization.
And I will just say, good luck to the Lowy Institute. We need you thinking down there.
COVIDcast is a limited edition weekly podcast from the Lowy Institute. Thank you to my colleague, Jennifer Reinhardt, for production assistance. Please keep an eye on our social media channels for details of the next episode of COVIDcast, and you can stay up to date with all the latest developments on coronavirus via the Lowy Institute's widely read digital magazine, The Interpreter. Thank you all for listening today, and we'll catch up with you again next week.